Hello, everyone. Welcome to Good to Grow, a podcast from FMC dedicated to exploring the latest trends in row crop management and sharing agronomic best practices. I'm your host, Randy Conan. For today's episode, I have the pleasure of being joined by both Pat Tranel, Professor and Associate Head of Crop Sciences at the University of Illinois, and Aaron Hager, Associate Professor and Extension Weed Scientist for the University of Illinois. We'll be discussing metabolism-based herbicide resistance. What exactly is it, the threat it poses, and what we can do to curb the issue. Now, since Aaron's been a guest on this podcast before, Pat, let's have you go first. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Okay, well, first, thanks for having me here, Randy. I'm a weed scientist here in the Department of Crop Sciences at the University of Illinois. I've been here for about 20 years, over 20 years now. In addition to being trained as a weed scientist, I've also been trained as a molecular biologist. And so my research in the area of weed sciences focuses more on the basic aspects of weeds and is done in the lab. I work a lot with Aaron and other weed extension scientists. Aaron's sort of the eyes out there in the field for me. He brings me problems that farmers are facing. I call those opportunities. I do the basic research in the lab, try to understand that better to support the more applied research he does out in the field. And then I pass my findings on to him, and then he takes it back to the growers and the producers out there to try and improve their weed management strategies. So it's been a good interaction for over 20 plus years. Weed scientists have good job security, and so we still have a few more problems left to solve.
Aaron, we've had you on the show last year. What have you been up to since we talked last?
Still, Randy, trying to run down some of the new challenges that are facing Illinois farmers. As Pat indicated, we've still got quite a few problems yet to solve. We haven't got all of them solved yet, but we continue to try to be vigilant for the new challenges, trying to work our way through and help farmers in their weed management programs. And again, collaborating with the more basic weed scientists that my colleagues at the University of Illinois, trying to get the best information back to them, because as we're going to learn during this podcast, when we talk about metabolic resistance, there's still a lot of things that are completely unknown yet. So with the work of my colleagues, I think we're getting closer day by day to better understanding what these challenges of metabolic resistance are really going to mean.
Now, you mentioned the metabolic resistance. Really, it's a term that I really hadn't been aware of or around of a lot before. Is it still a newer concept?
Well, the concept of metabolic resistance in some ways isn't that new, in that a lot of our crop plants, the reason that they are able to withstand a lot of the herbicides that are used in those crops is because those crops are able to metabolize those herbicides. So this idea that a plant can metabolize a herbicide to make it non-toxic to that plant, that's been around for quite some time. In terms of metabolic resistance occurring in weeds, it first showed up back in the 1980s, primarily in grass species, and then particularly more so outside the U.S. So Australia was dealing with ryegrass with metabolic resistance. Europe was dealing with blackgrass with metabolic resistance. And, you know, since obviously it's occurred in other places as well here in the U.S., but primarily metabolic resistance has been a problem in grass species. You know, a little closer here to home here in Illinois, in water hemp, we really did not see metabolic-based herbicide resistance until, I believe it was 2003. But it's really only been, I would say, in the last 5 to 10 years where metabolic resistance in a broadleaf weed like water hemp has really started to take off and become a real concern for our producers here in the Midwest.
Aaron, you're seeing that out in the field then for sure, ground truthing that.
Oh, without a doubt. We see instances of poor weed control now. Usually when I get involved with either a complaint or simply an observation going down the road, you may not always have all the background information that you need, whether or not to determine that you have a new instance of resistance possibly. But with our extensive network of contacts out in the state, we do have annual requests from a lot of different entities within the state that says, you know, we sprayed this and we simply didn't control this particular population. And as Pat mentioned, most times it's water hemp. Can we send you some seed? And can you actually screen this for us in the greenhouse? And we really never know for sure what we're going to get. And to give you an example, we have instances where we were sent a sample of a water hemp population to screen for one type of resistance in the greenhouse. And lo and behold, we found, Pat can help me here, three or four other types of resistance in that population, just because we went and took the time to look for it. So this is something, and based on work from Pat's lab years and years ago, looking at the aspect of why some of these resistances tend to accumulate in water hemp, for example, once we see these types of resistance present in the population, unfortunately, they're going to stay there for a long time. So in other words, if we have instances where we have resistance evolved, whether it be a metabolic resistance or a target site resistance, if we don't use that particular herbicide on that population for, let's say, 10 years, and so year 11, we think, well, maybe it'll work this time, and we go back and we try it, we're going to find out it's going to work as poorly as what it did 11 years ago. So this is the concern that we have, especially now when we're dealing with metabolic resistance, and I'm sure Pat will explain this better a little bit later, we really have very low predictability in terms of what herbicides may still remain effective against any particular population in the field.
When comparing it to other forms of weed resistance, how does it stack up?
There's two broad categories of herbicide resistance in plants, the way we think about it. There's target site resistance, where what typically happens there is there's a mutation in the gene that encodes the target site of the herbicide, which is usually an enzyme, a protein that does some function in the plant. A herbicide normally blocks that protein from doing its function, and that's what kills the plant. But if you have a mutation in the right spot in the right gene, and you have a change in that herbicide target site such that the herbicide target site now no longer binds the herbicide, that allows that plant to be resistant to that herbicide. So that's target site resistance. The other broad category of resistance is non-target site resistance. And that's basically a catch-all term for any other change the plant might make to become resistant. One example, for example, maybe the plant has a thicker cuticle, and so less of the herbicide gets in. That would just kind of be one example. But usually when we're talking about non-target site resistance, we're talking about this metabolic resistance, where the plant acquires the ability to break down that herbicide into non-toxic products. And how the plant does that is that's something that, you know, research is ongoing to understand it. And again, as I mentioned at the beginning, it's very much like, or it's identical to how crops in a lot of cases are tolerant to herbicides. Corn, we've been spraying atrazine on cornfields for years. And the reason you can do that without killing corn is able to detoxify that herbicide. And we even know some of the genes, or at least the gene families, the family of enzymes that are involved in this herbicide detoxification. And we're starting to understand those better. One of the things that's challenging is with target site resistance, we know what the target of the herbicide is. And so if we suspect target site resistance, we know what the enzyme is, we know what the gene is, we can go and specifically look at that gene and ask if it's changed or not. And if it has, then we can confirm target site resistance. With non-target site resistance, specifically with metabolic resistance, there's literally hundreds, if not thousands, of potential genes or enzymes that could be involved in that resistance. And so it's really more of a fishing trip where you have to cast this wide net and figure out, okay, what in this plant might have changed? And to add one more level of challenge or difficulty to that is oftentimes for this non-target site resistance, this metabolic resistance, it's not just one enzyme or it's not just one gene. It could be multiple genes. It's a multigenic trait where different enzymes work together to detoxify that herbicide. And so trying to figure out what those different enzymes are, how they're working together, and then what are the changes that make them now able to metabolize the herbicide? Why couldn't the plant previously metabolize it? Has the enzyme changed so now it recognizes the herbicide, or is the enzyme just changed such that now there's more of that enzyme being produced in the plant, so there's more enzyme available to detoxify the herbicide? So that's a long answer to your question, I'm sure, but hopefully it kind of points out the complexity of this metabolic resistance.
Well, that kind of ties into my next question, was when you compare metabolic resistance to the target site resistance, it's a much more serious issue.
Yeah. So one of the big concerns with metabolic resistance is this idea of cross resistance that I believe Aaron alluded to earlier. So with target site resistance, that resistance is only going to affect herbicides with that same target. And so that makes it very predictable. If I have a target site change in ALS, which is acetylactate synthate, which is the target site of sulfonylureas and imidazolinones. Okay, if I have target site resistance to the sulfonylureas and imidazolinones, then that resistance is not going to affect herbicides with other target sites. And so from that perspective, it's relatively easy to manage. You just rotate your herbicide group numbers. With metabolic resistance, that enzyme that's able to metabolize the herbicide, it doesn't care, it doesn't matter what target that herbicide has. It just is able to metabolize it if that herbicide molecule has the right structure that enables that enzyme to bind it. And so there might be other herbicides with completely different target sites that also can be metabolized by that enzyme. And so you have these enzymes that can potentially affect a broader range of herbicides. And therefore, that makes it really unpredictable. We don't really know, other than usually by trial and error, what other herbicides that metabolic resistance might extend to.
How do we get to this position?
Well, you know, that's a very interesting question, Randy. And I don't know that we really have the answer for that question yet. And, you know, the reason we say this, and Pat did a great job of explaining kind of what, I guess, the one way you could think about target site resistance, that's more of a specialist, whereas metabolic resistance, you could think of it more as a generalist. And so when we look at various populations that we have examined fairly intensely, we see instances where we can find resistance to, say, HPPD inhibitors, widely used products in corn. History of those products being used in that particular field, then it makes sense. But we also now are finding instances where we can find resistance to herbicides to in a population that was never previously exposed to that herbicide. And so what we've found in at least two, if not more, populations of water hemp is that we see some similarities in the resistance profiles. We see resistance to HPPD inhibitors. We have seen resistance to group 15 herbicides like metolachlor and acetachlor, for example. And we've also seen resistance or at least reduced sensitivity to group 4 herbicides, things like 2,4-D and dicamba. And also in these populations, we see metabolic resistance to atrazine. And so I guess it really begs the question, are we seeing this because we have used products like atrazine for 60 years in the Midwest? Is it because we've used group 15 herbicides for 55 years? Is it because of HPPD use now for approximately 25 years? Or is it the fact that we have used group 4 products for close to 70 years right now? So we really don't know for sure if it was one particular use pattern that has resulted in this, or if these plants are simply experimenting in the field with different genetic combinations that allows them to withstand whatever that we're going to try to apply to them for their control in any given growing season.
It makes it more difficult to find chemicals that actually work then, doesn't it?
Well, the other insidious thing, and I'll use that term kind of loosely, about metabolic resistance is that it's quite possible that there could be a new mode of action sitting in a laboratory somewhere that may or may not be effective against some of these populations, even though it's never been commercially available before. Again, that's some of the challenges that companies are facing right now as they're trying to look at bringing new modes of action, bringing new molecules into the marketplace in these fairly unpredictable times around these metabolic resistances in species like water hemp. And as a similar parallel, a lot of work that's going on right now with Palmer Amaranth, a lot of the results are fairly similar to what we're seeing in water hemp. So two very important broadleaf species across millions of acres here in the Midwest and the Mid-South.
Any idea of a catalyst at all, or is that what we're trying to look for?
I think it's important to recognize that anytime you spray a herbicide on a weed population, you are putting a selection pressure on that population. You are selecting for resistance. And so we've been doing this for decades now. And after decades of these plants being selected, I think they are just starting to accumulate some of these different enzymes and genes that maybe previously, you know, going back to like the ALS inhibitors, we had target site resistance to ALS inhibitors in water hemp a long time ago. And so it didn't really need a gene or an enzyme to metabolize an ALS inhibitor, but nevertheless, it's still selecting for those type, potentially in some plants, selecting for those types of genes. And so over time, as Aaron said, the populations are, through evolution, experimenting with these different combinations. And so I think it's just, you know, I think it's a matter of time as you continue to select with different herbicides, you continue to select for plants that are, have these generalist mechanisms such as metabolism that can help them to, you know, avoid or be resistant to a wide range of different herbicide molecules.
We talked earlier a little bit about the when and the where, the how these first cases were identified. Are we seeing this expand? I guess if we've come from Australia to the U.S., it's expanding.
Aaron, do you want to take that one?
Well, I think what we're going to have to come to realize is, as Pat said, and he explained it quite well, every application of a herbicide selects for some type of resistance. In our dioecious pigweed species, like the water hemp and the Palmer amaranth, because of their genetic diversity in these species, they can easily experiment with literally millions of different genetic combinations every year. And if you think about the dioecious nature of a species like water hemp, every plant is either a male or a female. Males produce the pollen, females produce a large quantity of seed. But you have to remember, there's no biological law that says that all those flowers on that female have to be pollinated by one male. It doesn't necessarily work that way. So theoretically, she could receive pollen from hundreds, if not thousands, of different male plants. And again, think about the genetic diversity of the offspring of these types of crosses. And when you have such genetic diversity in these dioecious species, again, they're able to do this in-field experimentation, if you will, to try to find the right combination of genes that allows the next generation to have a better opportunity to survive whatever the treatment is. And so we really don't know right now what could be the best herbicide recommendations to make in light of this metabolic resistance. It's kind of it's a bit of a guess whether or not something is going to remain effective. And remember, just because something was effective in 2020, it may or may not be effective in 2021. And it really brings up an important point, I think we try to stress now with farmers, is that those few remaining plants at the end of the year, let's say in a soybean field that you may not think are really hurting anything, they're not going to plug up the combine. They're scattered across 40 acres. There are really not any big patch of them. But just remember, all those plants that are females and have been successfully pollinated and produce seed, that has seed that has gone through another cycle of selection. And even though you may not think that they're really hurting in anything in the field now, those seeds may carry the traits for the next type of resistance mechanism into that field, into that population, going into the next growing season.
Fair amount of research also being conducted on the subject of metabolic resistance. Can you provide an update on some of the latest findings?
Yeah, sure. So as I said, it's unlike target site resistance, which is a more targeted research approach, this is more of a cast a wide net and see what you find out there. And so we've been doing that. My lab and other labs have been doing that using the latest genomic-based research platforms. So these are, you know, research approaches that we weren't able to take in a weed like water hemp just 5 years ago because we didn't have those genomic resources available. But now we have those. And so that's allowing us to start identifying these genes that are potentially responsible. And so several labs now have identified some genes. We still have a long way to go. We still don't know, you know, what is the change in that gene that makes it now resistant? Has the mutation changed that enzyme's ability to latch onto a herbicide molecule, whereas before it could not? Or has that mutation just caused that gene to be more abundantly expressed, so there's more of that enzyme to detoxify that herbicide faster? That's still a black box to us right now. Also, we don't have a good handle on this multigenic nature. How are these genes working together? How many different genes are involved? You know, what is one gene providing some resistance to herbicide A, and then a second gene provides resistance to herbicide B? Or is there some overlap where gene A can do a little bit, provide some resistance to herbicide A and B? You know, so there's a lot there to be sorted out in terms of how to be able to really understand how this resistance works. Ultimately, you know, one of the long-term objectives is if we can figure out which genes these plants are using, maybe we can come up with ways either to block those genes or other approaches maybe to try and overcome this metabolic resistance. So that's there's hope, but that's a long way in the future.
And Aaron, you kind of alluded to this before too, as far as management goes, there are some things that growers can do to stem the issue. One of those, as you alluded to, is zero tolerance.
Well, again, our predictability is so poor when we get into the area of metabolic resistance. And frankly, we're going to continue to use herbicides. They're not necessarily going to go away anytime in the foreseeable future. But I really think because of the issues and the uncertainties with metabolic resistance, we're going to have to come to the conclusion that we're going to have to do something in addition to the herbicides to try to ensure that by the end of the growing season that there's been no successful seed production. Because if there's been no successful seed production in a field, that means there's been no change in any allelic frequency of any resistance mechanism. That's the win. You know, we see populations in water hemp right now that have resistance to herbicides from six different classes. Sooner rather than later, we're going to find population that has seven. After that, it's going to be eight. So the point of it is that the water hemp is going to continue to accumulate these mechanisms to confer resistance to even more and more classes of herbicides. So we're going to have to do something, again, to try to ensure that the seed production is limited in the field, because the weakness of water hemp is really the fact that the seeds do not remain viable in the soil seed bank indefinitely. It's not something like a velvet leaf seed that can hang around in the seed bank for 30, 40, 50 years. You know, research has shown that on average, water hemp seed is probably going to lose its viability by about 5 to 7 years in the soil. And so if you take that piece of information, that very simple piece of information, and put it into a real life scenario, anything that you can do, any multitude of things that a farmer could do to try to ensure that there's no seed produced in any field for about 3 to 4 consecutive years, what you're going to start to see is that your water hemp populations really begin to plummet. They have to. That's based on the biology of their seed. That's the weakness of the population. If we think we can maintain long-term control by simply opening up a different jug of a different herbicide that comes in the marketplace, then I'm afraid we really haven't learned the very important lesson of water hemp, that it's eventually going to overcome this. But again, if we do open that new jug, and hopefully one day there will be some new jugs, keep in mind that it's not necessarily going to be of a product where resistance is not going to evolve. So the more that we can do to really steward new products coming into the marketplace right off, you know, year one, the better the likelihood that we're going to continue to have effectiveness of those products for longer in the future.
Is the metabolic resistance primarily in the pigweed species then versus other weeds?
Well, as I said, initially, metabolic resistance showed up in grass species. And there's some clues, some ideas as to why that might be. We're not really sure, though. But it did seem to show up originally in the grass species. And it's really only been in the last few years where it's become more common in these broadleaf species. But in general, the weeds where we see metabolic resistance in the most are weeds that are outcrossed. So water hemp and palmer being dioecious, separate male and female, they're obviously outcrossed. The ryegrass and the black grass that I mentioned earlier, they're also outcrossed. So there are some exceptions. There are some other weeds that are primarily self-pollinated. But in general, when you have a weed that, you know, is found on a significant numbers of acres and is able to outcross, that weed is probably evolving resistance and probably evolving metabolic resistance.
Before we close, anything else the audience needs to know or consider about metabolic resistance?
Well, I really think that Aaron just said that we're not going to stop using herbicides. And I agree, we're not going to stop using herbicides next year or 5 years from now. But I really do think that this metabolic resistance could be, you know, and this is a dire statement, I think this could be the beginning of the end of herbicides as, you know, standalone weed control tools. You know, as Aaron pointed out, there are probably new modes of action being investigated that might just stay on the shelf because our populations have already evolved resistance to them, even though they've never seen them. And so you combine that fact with the challenge in getting a new herbicide registered, there's not going to be a ton of new herbicides coming on the market. And so we really need to steward the ones that we have and start looking, as Aaron said, into these non-chemical strategies to support our herbicides, to support our herbicides in managing weeds.
Aaron, any final comments?
You know, I think as we reflect back on some of the statements and conversation that we've had here today, Randy, it may seem like a gloom and doom scenario. In some ways, it actually is, and I agree completely with what Pat just said. And the last thing I'd really like to leave with the listeners, please take this seriously, because this is happening. And perhaps just because maybe you haven't seen this yet on your farm, don't, you know, it would be actually a mistake to think that it could never happen to you. And again, the most challenging parts of resistance is, again, with the metabolic resistance, having no predictability, thinking that, you know, the program I used last year worked really, really well, so I'm going to continue to use it this year. But finding out during the middle of the season that it really didn't work. And by the time we realize it didn't work, the weeds are too large, we really don't have an effective rescue treatment for that. So again, take this very, very seriously. It's not the end of the world as we know it, but I think it's certainly going to be a catalyst for change in the very near future.
Well, this has been an eye-opening and interesting discussion, at least on my part anyway. So I want to say thank you to both of you guys for taking the time here and visit with us here today.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Good to Grow. If you'd like to learn more about metabolism-based herbicide resistance or hear more podcast episodes, visit fmcgoodtogrow.com, ag.fmc.com, or cropsciences.illinois.edu. To get updates on future Good to Grow episodes, you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or Google Podcasts. If you want to let us know what you think about the show or have ideas for future topic discussions, send a message to FMC Ag US on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram. We'd love to hear from you. I'm Randy Conan, and you've been listening to Good to Grow by FMC. Always read and follow all label directions, precautions, and restrictions for use. FMC is a trademark of FMC Corporation or an affiliate.